Well, hasn't this been awesome? Just a way to start off the morning, isn't it? Life change, praising God. Thankful for all of you family members, friends that came to be a part of the baptisms. I know the ones that were baptized, it meant everything to them for you guys to be here. And we're honored that you came to spend time with us also. This morning, I'm going to start us in our new series entitled Shortcuts. And I thought the way I would do that is share a story with you that I saw in the media this past week. And the story that I saw, maybe some of you saw it as well, took place on October the 11th, just a number of days ago, in London, England. And what took place was, in London, England, is that they were having a big marathon. And it was like the news. It was a big deal. It was a 26.2-mile marathon. Now, I don't know about you, but I've never walked 26.2 miles consecutively, much less ran 26.2 miles. But this is what these guys were going to do. And so they had this marathon that they were holding, and they expected a lot of contestants and a lot of spectators. And that's exactly what happened. There were tons of people that came to run in the race, and there were a ton of people who came to observe and to watch the race. Well, this event took off without a hitch. Actually, it took off with a bang, as they always do, right? As all the runners got in the starting gate, they fired the gun, and they all took off on this run. Well, hours into it, the race was still just moving along as normal. And then hours later, these individuals actually saw, the spectators did, the very first person cross the finish line, the guy that won the race. And then within a few minutes behind him, another guy crossed the finish line. And then the third place guy crossed the finish line. Well, after this, of course, you had your gold medal winner, your silver medal winner, and then your bronze medal winner. They took those guys, and with friends and family, after probably hydrating themselves, settling down a little bit, they started celebrating their victory. And then as they did so, they ended up taking them over to the area where they were going to award them their medals. And so they had the guy that won the gold in the center, and on one side or the other, the guy with the silver and the guy with the bronze, and they handed them their medals individually, took photos and all that. Well, with the third place guy, the bronze medal, his name was Rob Sloan. And I think we have a picture of him I want to put up here for you. This is Rob. And Rob won third place, the bronze medal. So here he is. He looks pretty happy. Looks pretty sweaty, too, doesn't he? Yeah, that was a long run. And Rob won third place. And afterwards, they were all interviewed by the media and asked questions, you know, the whole thing. And Rob actually beat his best time up to this point by around 20-25 minutes. So it was a successful run. Well, what was very intriguing was just shortly after the interviews, the photographs, the awards celebration, the whole deal, there were rumblings that started kind of spreading out within the crowd and actually amongst the organizers of the marathon. And the rumblings were stirred up by the guy who came in fourth place. Okay? And he just started talking. It looked kind of like sour grapes. The dude just wasn't happy. But what was interesting is what he had to say. He actually went to the organizers of the race and he said, "Here's the issue I have. When we started this race and as we ran for those hours on end to the end goal, I saw the first place guy that won the gold. He was ahead of me the whole time. I saw the second place guy who won the silver. He was ahead of me the whole time also. But I never saw the third place guy that won the bronze medal." He said, "I never saw him pass me. He was never around me. I just never saw the dude." To which when they went to Rob Sloan, they mentioned this to him. The media did. And he said, "Oh, that's laughable. Dude's just upset. He needs to get a life." But what else was interesting was then more rumbling started stirring. And these individuals started coming forward and they said, "You know, actually, at mile 20 in that race, I saw a sweaty runner flag down a spectator bus. And then he got on it." And then these other people said, "Yeah, I saw that too." And then just drove on past all the other runners. And not only that, but then other people started coming forward and said, "I saw this sweaty runner standing in the woods behind a tree, hiding. And then after the first couple guys ran, he comes darting out. I didn't know what he was doing. He had to go to the bathroom. You know, what's going on?" And so when all this stuff started stirring up, these people went to Rob and the organizers, and then he finally crumbled. Rob, actually, at mile 20, was so fatigued and worn out, he said, "Uncle," waved down a spectator bus. And these spectator buses, those double-stack things, that's what he jumped on. He went on this thing with spectators, okay, this hot, sweaty runner, rides this thing all the way down to the end, basically, hops off, hides in the woods, waits for the other guys to pass him, and he runs out and medals in third place in the bronze medal. Isn't that awesome? So any of you like me that hate running, that's what you need to do. Just get someone to pick you up and take you to the end, right? And then you just run out in front of everybody. Now, that's terrible. You see, what was interesting is when you think about what Rob did, is Rob ultimately cheated, didn't he? Now, he got caught, but he cheated. But how did he cheat? He took a shortcut, right? Now, he didn't take a shortcut like cutting across a field and, you know, when the race was going this way. He shortcutted via a bus. That's what he did. It just went on around and went past everyone. That's what Rob did. And so Rob took a shortcut. And this past week, I've been thinking a lot about shortcuts, okay? And I've been thinking about, why is it that we take shortcuts? What is it that appeals to us about taking a shortcut? And here's what I think. Shortcuts, when we look for them or tempted by them or try to seek one out, actually provides something for us. It helps us get from where we are to where we want to be with in less time and with less energy spent. It can be physical energy, it can be emotional energy, it can be any type of energy, but it's to do it quicker, to accomplish this task, to accomplish this feat quicker. And so we look for shortcuts all the time. And I was thinking about some of the shortcuts I took, and I'm going to share some with you. I'm sure you have some growing up. And students or any of you that are still in school, do not take notes on this, okay? But in high school, whenever we had a book report or an exam due, I would go out and I'd buy Cliff Notes. Any of you ever do this? And, you know, the added bonus is if there was a movie about the book. Isn't that right? So I didn't want to expend the energy and the time to read the book. I would rather watch a 2-hour movie and then read Cliff Notes. But I learned pretty quickly after about 2 episodes of that, the teacher knew that we were probably reading Cliff Notes and watching movies, and the questions just were so different from the movie and the book or the Cliff Notes that I didn't do too well on my exams. Another way that we've taken shortcuts is whenever you move through, you know, November, which is coming up soon, by the way, Christmas and New Year's, is that by the time the warm weather comes around and there's, you know, spring weather and the summer is fastly approaching, I don't know what you do, but I tend to kind of do this, and I notice a little extra here. And so what we want to do is we want to get rid of this, don't we? But instead of thinking about, well, I need to go to the gym, what many of us do is we get on Google and start looking for pills to take to dump the extra weight, don't we? It's a shortcut. We're just trying to melt the fat away without expending the energy. Now, come on, you know you do this. Without expending or shock it. There's another thing that shocks it. You know, that's awesome. But whatever you have to do to get rid of this extra that you don't want to carry into the summertime, that's what we do. And, you know, when you think about shortcuts, just to be fair, because I know some of you are thinking this, not all shortcuts are bad, are they? Because sometimes you find yourself in a process and you say, this process makes no sense. I'm without this. There's no value in these steps in this process. They're non-value added steps. And so for me, I need to eliminate some of these non-value added steps to get from here to here, and nothing's wasted. A good example of that is on your computer at home, where you have icons, shortcuts to open software programs, right? To where you can just click it, open it up, and then within seconds you have the software versus going menu bar, scroll up, find Office, Windows, and then, you know, keep moving through it and select your software. So sometimes they work, but then there's other times they actually can be very, very detrimental. They can actually harm you. They can hurt you. Stephen Covey, who's written books, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, The 8th Habit, and others. Stephen Covey even said that back in college, there was one particular course that he cheated his way through to just get to his end goal. And afterwards, after years of, I think, feeling kind of bad about it, he figured out that he took a shortcut around it, bypassed or avoided the studies, and now he didn't have the information or the knowledge he needed to succeed. So Stephen Covey, unlike most people, went back to school and took the course over again to actually learn the information. Another way that it's detrimental, and this is just one example, is actually with those that have taken steroids before. Is that you have where you are, you have where you want to go, you want to get there as quick as you can, get beefed up or ripped up, whatever you want to do. And so the way you think you do it is either by shooting steroids, taking pills, whatever, to be able to get there quicker. And sadly, we know all too well about the problems with steroids, psychologically, physically, and even not in your life only, but in the lives of others. You see, shortcuts can be okay in some ways, but in many ways, shortcuts can harm you. Today, I want to talk about a shortcut that is far more harmful, far more impactful, if you will, in your life, and it's spiritual. Today, I want to talk about something that goes beyond the muscles and the fat and the running races and all that stuff. I want to talk about a spiritual shortcut that I believe many, 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 many of us have taken or are currently taking, and maybe you don't even know that you're taking it. The way to introduce this, I think, is to tell you a little bit about Jesus. Jesus clearly was the wisest teacher, greatest leader, and looking today, now thousands of years later, the greatest influencer of all time. And Jesus in his day, when he was walking around doing ministry, he had many, many altercations with the religious leaders of his day. They fought with him about everything. I mean, they just picked at him about divorce. They picked him about this issue, that issue, everything. Always just trying to get something on Jesus. Well, when Jesus actually was leading into his last week of life, Jesus was approached by a group of guys that started trying to get him on paying taxes and trying to get him on divorce and all these big issues spiritually. And then one guy was observing this and he said, I'm going to go try to get him. And in Mark chapter 12, verse 28, and you don't have to turn here because we're going to turn a little bit. But in Mark chapter 12, verse 28, this guy that was a scribe went up to Jesus and he asked him this question. One of the scribes came up to him, heard them disputing one another, seeing that Jesus answered them well, asked him this: which commandment is the most important of all? Now, when he asked this question, here's what he was thinking. Is that in the old covenant of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, the law of Moses, there were 613 prohibitions or laws of things you're not to do. So he's looking at Jesus. He says, all right, spiritual dude, you got an answer for everything. Tell me, what's number one out of the 613? Put it at the top of the list for me. And here's what Jesus actually was doing. When Jesus answers him here, he's telling him this. This is the goal for life. This is what these individuals heard. And here's how Jesus answered in verse 29. The most important is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. This is the Shema. This is everything that individuals knew growing up in their time. They heard this, they memorized, they knew it. He said, our God is the one true God. And now based on that, watch this, verse 30, here's what Jesus said our goal is. And you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, all of your soul, with all of your mind, and with all of your strength. That Jesus sits here, he's asked what is the most important thing in life, what is the goal of life, what is the thing we should aim for at all times. And Jesus said this, it's love God with all of your being, with every thought, with every word, with every passion, with every action. Everything is to be about God. It's about loving God. It's all about God. And you know, in their day, they had a lot of different goals. And that's why this individual asked. I mean, there's 613 of them. I'm trying to aim. You know, where do I aim? What's the big deal? And Jesus said, if you get this one right, you get them all right. You get this one wrong, you get them all wrong. It's that important. It is the goal, the end goal and focus of life. Now, what's interesting about that is in a few chapters earlier in the Gospel of Mark, in chapter 7, Jesus actually had a little run-in, another one of these run-ins. Now, this was a little before this, but this sheds a lot of light into what we're going to talk about today. And this was a situation where Jesus and his disciples were walking out and they were walking through fields and his disciples decided, I'm going to start plucking heads of grain. We looked at this passage just a few weeks ago. And when they did that, the rule was, of course, the man-made tradition of the elders was, is that before you took the grain and you ate it, you were to wash your hands from here to your elbows, okay? If you didn't do that, the people, the watchdogs, would get upset with you. Well, Jesus, guys, just went and ate it. So when this happened, watch with me in Mark chapter 7, verse 5, and watch what happens. And then the Pharisees, one of these groups of religious leaders, and the scribes asked Jesus about what his disciples just did. And here's what they said. Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of elders, but eat with defiled hands? And then Jesus looks at them and here's what he says. Well, did Isaiah prophesy of you? Say the word with me. Next word. Hypocrites. Now hang with me. These were guys that were the leaders of their day, spiritually and influencing everyone. And Jesus looks at them and says, you're a hypocrite. They knew a lot about God. They did a lot of things for God. And Jesus says, you're a hypocrite. And he says, this prophet years before was talking about you. And watch what he says. As it is written, this people, you guys, You honor me with your lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. You see, Jesus, when he spoke to these religious leaders at all times, he was always trying to get this point across. Is this is what matters, guys. And it's ultimately about the goal of loving God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And if you shortcut the heart, you miss it all. It doesn't matter how much you know about God. It doesn't matter how much you talk about God, how much you say or do for God. If this is not involved, if you don't love God, you miss it all. And he looked at them and said, y'all are hypocrites because you don't love God. Now, these were individuals that had memorized most of, if not all, of the Old Testament, especially the Torah, the books of Moses. These were individuals that told everyone how to live spiritually. These were individuals that had all this stuff on what they were doing and not doing. They were just outside. They looked perfect. And Jesus said, you're hypocrites, and here's why. This isn't there. And what I bet is that when Jesus quoted prophet Isaiah, and he said, you worship me, you say stuff with these, but this is so far from God, they probably said, he's right. Now, they didn't want to admit he was right, but they knew he was right. When he said, in vain you worship God, that threatened everything about their existence. It threatened everything about their position, their leadership. It threatened everything because what Jesus was saying is y'all are a sham. You don't get it. And so finally, many times, and in this case, in all of them, they turn around, they get mad, and they walk away. You see, the truth is today, and this is what I really believe, because I know it's been true in my life, and I've seen it in so many lives of other people, is that when you think about loving God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and when you think about how much you know about God and some of the things you do for God, is a lot of times this is not even there. That for a lot of us today, if we're really, really honest, our relationship, if you want to call it that, with God feels very, very hollow. It's religion. There's no heart in it. There's no love. There's no passion. We're just doing stuff. And that's exactly what Jesus said the Pharisees were doing as well. So let me ask you this morning, does God feel distant to you? Not that you don't know that he's there, but I mean, does God feel personal to you, intimate to you? Do you love God? Do you feel the love of God? Or do you just feel like you're just kind of going through the motions? Because if that's what you feel, if that's where you are with God, what Jesus is saying to you and what Jesus is saying to all of us is this, is you may sit here and sing songs and you may serve and you may give and you may worship, but my gosh, if you don't have your heart in loving God, or what you would call, or what I would call intimacy with God, you have nothing. So why is this the issue? Why is it that we feel like there's this chasm between us and God? Why do we not feel close to God? Why do we feel like something's missing, that it's hollow? Why is that? Why are our hearts in this condition? Well, I believe a story in the Old Testament will actually show us why. It's a story you've all heard about, even as kids growing up. It's the story of the Exodus. And this story begins actually in the book of Genesis, where God makes a promise to Abraham that he's going to make of him a great nation. And through Abraham, he's going to bless all the nations of the world. And today we're seeing that as well through Christ ultimately. And after God makes this promise, there's Jacob, there's Isaac, Jacob, and then of course Joseph, the coat of many colors. Joseph dies, but before he died, he led all of his family into Egypt. Now we're 400 years later. And the children of Egypt cry out in Exodus chapter 2 to God, saying, God, where are you? They were enslaved by Pharaoh. God hears their cry. God remembers his promise to Abraham. God goes to Moses, burning bush, not consumed, and says, hey, Moses, come here. I hear their cry, and I want to send you to go take them out. Moses said, who am I going to tell them sending me? He said, you tell them I am who I am sent you. And what that meant to Moses and what that meant to those that heard it was this. God is saying to them, I'm here for you. I heard your cry. I've sent Moses and we're taking you out. Through a series of 9 plagues, Pharaoh hardens his heart. God hardens his heart and he will not let them go free. Finally, God tells Moses, he says, Moses, go to all the peeps. All the children of Israel say, put on your sandals, get your staff, get ready, because tonight you're going out. Or in the morning. And then he told him about the blood to paint that over the lintel and the doorpost. And he said, get ready. And sure enough, that night, what is now today known as the Passover, God passed over all the houses of the children of Israel. But he took the firstborn of all those of Egypt. The next morning, Pharaoh, when all their children were dead, Pharaoh goes to God, to Moses. He says, Moses, get out of here. Take all and everything you want. Get your people and go. Get the flip out of Egypt, okay? And he may have said something else. I don't know. But get out of here. And so Moses and all of them get their stuff, 600,000 plus men and women, children. They get their stuff, all the stuff they could take, and they go. Shortly into their story, they're down by the Red Sea. Pharaoh's army comes after them. They want them to serve him again. God parts the sea. They walk through the sea. He drowns all their armies. After that, they start screaming about wanting water. God has Moses throw a stick into the water, turns it from bitter water into sweet water. Then they want bread. God provides manna from heaven every morning. 6 days, right? You with me? 6 days they collect it. Seventh day they rest it. They get manna from heaven. Then they want more water. So God has Moses strike a rock. He gives them more water. Then they wanted some meat to eat because they talk about all the pots and all the meat at home in Egypt, wanting to go back, and God provides meat for them. Then they wanted more water. Then God takes care of them with the battle of the Amalekites, and on and on and on. Okay? Now, what's the pattern we see here? God rescued these people. And in their journey, all they did was complain and grumble and whine against God. And in each case, they wanted to turn back, go back to Egypt, turn their back on God. And all they wanted was, what have you done for me lately, God? And every time, God provided what they wanted. And every time, God provided what they needed. Finally, the story comes to a conclusion, really, of what we're going to talk about today. In the book of Numbers, God takes them all over to just right on the cusp of the land flowing with milk and honey, the promised land of Canaan. And he sends some spies in. The spies come back. Some of them are saying it's doomsday. Caleb was saying, no, we can go in and do this with God. And after this happened, the people freaked out like no other, like meltdown freaking out. And they start going crazy and they start telling Moses again, you brought us out here to die. We need to go back to Egypt. They took up stones. They were going to kill Moses and Aaron and Joshua and Caleb. They were going to kill them all. And they said, we're going to get us another leader and we're going back and we're going to go back to Pharaoh and go back to that enslavement. And so Moses goes over to God. And he's like, God, what do I do with these people? They want to kill me. And look with me at Numbers chapter 14, verse 11, what God said to Moses. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will this people despise me? And how long will they not believe in me in spite of all the signs that I have done among them? God shakes his head in looking at these people, the people he rescued out of their enslavement because he heard their cry, the people he took across the Red Sea to save their lives, the people he provided water for, not once, three times, the ones that he provided bread for every day, the ones he provided meat for every day, the ones that he took care of with the Amalekites. And he says, my goodness, look at what I've done for them. And all along the way, all they do is they shake their fist in my face. What have you done for me, God? And they have none of it. You know, the sad thing is what happened to those children of Israel, and I think this is subtle and it's in many of our hearts today, is that when Jesus said the goal is intimacy with God, they bypassed that. They never believed in God. No matter what he did for them, no matter how much he loved them, no matter how much mercy and grace he showed them, they didn't believe in God. And what they did is they set another goal for their life that they pursued. And their goal was to use God, to leverage God, to get what ultimately they wanted in life. You see, in our lives today, there are many of us that know a whole lot about God. We're in a time where there have been more books written than in any other time in history that are on shelves, and you can buy them. Heck, you can download them and read all you want about God. We're in a time that across the world, there are more churches, places of worship than any other time in history. And more people today are saying, I'm not satisfied with God. This experience with God has not turned out for what I thought it would be. And on and on and on. And guys, here's the problem. It's not God. It's you. It's me. Just as we look at the children of Israel and just how we see how they shortcutted the relationship with God. Because see, what God did all that for was not ultimately to take them into a little land over here in Canaan and establish that. That's not the real end goal, the ultimate goal. God was doing all those things along the way to get their heart. God was good to them. He blessed them. He provided. He showed grace and mercy because he wanted a relationship. God's goal is always your heart, for him to love you and for you to love him and to experience intimacy with him. But they traded it. They shortcutted it. They had their own goal. And their goal was, what have you done for me lately, God? And see, today, I believe that's the same issue. In the day of Jesus, it was the same issue. Is that these individuals just tried to leverage and use God for what they could get out of it. Not get to know and love and worship and adore God in intimacy. You know what's so striking, though, is in Exodus chapter 33. Moses, who recorded, of course, these events in Genesis, Exodus, and the other books, first five books of the Old Testament, he records and gives a little insight into an event that took place, and I'm sure probably daily. And I want to share this with you, and it's Exodus 33, verse 7, and I want you to just get a glimpse of this. Now, Moses used to take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, far off from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting. So you have all these millions of Jewish people, children of Israel, up here. Moses would walk out here, pinch a little tent, his prayer closet, if you will. He would go, and everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. And whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people would, watch this, rise up. Each would stand at his tent door and watch Moses until he had gone into the tent. 9, Moses entered the tent, the cloud would descend and the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. And when all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would rise up and worship each at his tent door. Think about that. Moses goes down to his tent. He goes in the tent. The cloud comes down, the presence of God. All these people are watching. And then as soon as he goes in there, they start worshiping God. They see him having time alone with God, and they worship. They had a, if you will, a bird's eye view watching what God was doing in the life of Moses. And look at what verse 11 says. Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. You see, the contrast between Moses with these people was pretty clear. Moses faced the same challenges and even greater challenges than they did. Because Moses not only had the water issue for himself, he had the water issue for millions of people that he was leading, right? Moses not only saw that Red Sea for himself, he saw it for all the people he was leading. Moses not only saw the issue for bread and all these other things, he saw it for the people he was leading. But not one time do you see Moses in the whole Exodus account and Numbers freak out before the people going, I don't know what we're going to do. God, why did you do this to me? He did say that one time, but it was like, God, why are you making me lead these people? They're a pain in the rear. Okay, that was the only time he said it. But he never did that. Moses would in every case go to God. Why? What fueled Moses' confidence, what fueled Moses' life was not what he knew about God. It wasn't what he was doing for God. It was none of that. It was his intimacy with God. He was his father. He was his leader. He was the one who rescued them. He was his source of power and confidence. He knew God. The same was true with Jesus. In Jesus' life, as he faced the cross, as he faced the healings, as he faced the dead, as he faced those that were mute, the blind, all the others, as he faced them, not once do you see Jesus throw his hands up and go, I don't know what to do. In every case, Jesus, as we see modeled, from the relationship and the intimacy with his heavenly Father, he led, he healed, he spoke with authority, he did all these things. Why? His goal, like the goal of Moses, was not getting from God. It was not leveraging anything with God. It was to know God. It was to love God. It was to experience God personally. God has that for you. God has that for me. And it's through what Jesus did on the cross. Because of what Jesus did, all of us, every person, has the opportunity to go into before God and to say, Abba, Father. We have the opportunity to get alone with God, to know God, to experience God for ourselves. We don't have to be like the children of Israel looking down at Moses and going, wow, that's so awesome. I wish I could have that. No, that's what God has for you. That's what you were created for. That's what your heart cries out for. Why did those people worship when they saw that happen? Because it was awesome. Because they know inside themselves they want that. You know that you want that. Because that's what God created you for. It's not religion that's hollow. Not about all this doing for God and knowing about God. But it is knowing God. Personally. Intimately. In your life. So let me ask you a question this morning. If God feels distant to you, can you look at the children of Israel and the story of the Exodus and identify with them and say, hey, they changed their goal. They tried to avoid the relationship with God. They didn't believe in God. They didn't love God. They didn't surrender out of humility to God. Could that be you? If that's you, God still stands before you, and through Christ, he says, I open my arms to you. You're my son. You're my daughter. I want you to know me. I want to love you. I want you to experience not this hollow religion. I want you to experience love and intimacy and the joy that only God can give. The Apostle Paul said it this way, Philippians chapter 3, verse 10. I'll put on here on the screen for you. Here's his life goal. That I may what? Say with me. Know him. That I may know him. You see, as your pastor, and some of you, I'm not your pastor, I'm your friend. My greatest desire in everything we do here at River City Church is for you to say that I may know him, that I may worship him, that I may experience him personally, that I may receive the nourishment of my soul. What it longs for is a loving relationship with God. Not that for you to watch others experience it and you just to get all excited about it. No, I want you to experience God yourself. I'll close by telling you just something personal. It's probably a few months back. I was driving down Memphis Arlington out in Arlington where I live. And I don't know why this happened, but I was just praying, talking to God. And I was just moved deeply that day. And what I was moved by is the picture of how Adam and Eve, before the fall, walked so closely with God in Eden. And God would come and just have this conversation with them and love them. And it was such a close relationship, unhindered by sin or separation. I thought about it, I said, wow. And then I thought about how Jesus, in his earthly life, for those 33 years, that Jesus would walk so intimately and so closely with God. And when he would speak, he would say, I'm saying the things God wants me to say to you. I'm doing the things God wants me to do right now. And I thought, wow, what would it be like? Imagine, what would it be like to be that close to God? And in that drive, I just said to God, Father, oh, for the day that I see you face to face. That I get to experience you without the hindering of my sin, without having to not be able to see you being on this earth and the separation there. But God, and I'm thankful that the Holy Spirit allows me to connect and experience worship and intimacy with God. But I'm like, man, what would it be like? I can't wait to see him face to face. And never again will I ever have to struggle with that sin and struggle with my problems and all these issues. But I get to see God and I get to experience God to the depths of who I'm created for. Guys, I'm telling you, that's what your soul wants to. Augustine said, our hearts are restless until they rest in you, O God. Your heart is restless. Do not shortcut your heart. Do not shortcut the goal of life by trying to create some new goal for you to get what you want and use God to get what you want. Don't do that. You'll never be satisfied. Pursue an intimate relationship with God through Jesus. That's what he's given you through Christ. Let me pray for us. Father, I thank you for this incredible day, how beautiful it is outside. God, how awesome it was to watch six people say that they have begun the journey with you. of trusting you, knowing you as Father, knowing you as their daddy, God, and just learning, growing in that process. And God, I pray for everyone who's here today. God, there's some people here that, man, they're just so indifferent toward you. If we were to say honestly what we really think, we just say, well, if God's out there, I just want him to basically take care of me and give me what I want. And God, that is just not your goal for us. That's not what you created us for. I pray by now, right now, by the Spirit here, that you would just change their hearts and lead them to know you, to want you, God. Father, I thank you for Jesus. I thank you that through him and by him only can we call you Father. And I thank you, Lord, for what you're doing by the Spirit of God, of you within us, changing us from the inside out. And I pray, Father, that you would just change all of us and that we would never, ever, ever be the same. It's in your name that I pray.